Good evening. It's a real pleasure for me to be here. And tonight, I'm going to be addressing a big question. Is there a link between autism and the uniquely human capacity for invention? And I hope to show you that there is a link. But first, when did invention begin? Well, we know that at least 2 million years ago, some of our ancestors were creating simple stone tools like hammers and axes.
A while ago, this guy, Simon Baron Cohen, filled up the big concert hall of the Danish National Broadcasting Corporation with curious and excited Science and Cocktails participants when he gave his talk, How Autism Drives Human Invention. And after the talk, there were more than 100 questions from the audience. And I picked out some of them and met Simon Baron Cohen on Zoom on a Friday afternoon.
So I'm gonna record it through Zoom.
Okay.
This podcast is basically Simon Baron Cohen answering those questions. So it's an extra contribution to the very interesting talk he gave in Copenhagen. And if you were not there, then you can watch the whole talk on Science and Cocktails YouTube channel.
Welcome to the Science and Cocktails podcast.
Get on your spaceship.
Interesting.
And now the machine is working.
Increase the frequency of lucid dreams in our laboratories.
Over time, the variation within a group becomes variation between groups.
It has to do with particles or objects and how they move.
Am I true? Am I awake?
We think that there is a kind of God against it.
What are the processes behind?
It's a piece of stuff.
We are moving in space-time. All of us go like 1 second per second, flowing up in the fourth dimension.
Before we go deeper into what autism is, the man Simon Baron Cohen requires a proper presentation.
So I'm Simon Baron Cohen, and I'm the director of the Autism Research Centre at Cambridge University in the UK. And our research centre looks at the causes of autism, but also at interventions that might be helpful for autistic people. And when I was in Copenhagen at the Science and Cocktails event, I talked about my recent book, which is called The Pattern Seekers, which makes a link between autism and invention. So human beings are, I think, unique in being able to invent generatively. That means we can invent unstoppably. And we've been doing this for between 70 and 100,000 years. But in my book and in my talk in Copenhagen, I laid out the evidence that there's a link between autistic people, the way their minds work, and the minds of inventors, because autistic people and inventors like to look for patterns in the world, and they like to kind of play with patterns or experiment with patterns to come up with new patterns. Not just understanding how things work, but understanding how a system could be improved. So it changes the way we think about autism, which traditionally has been thought of as a disorder, even a disease. It's changing it to a new way of thinking, which is about disability, certainly. That's why a person gets their diagnosis, but also about talent and difference. That autistic people are an example of neurodiversity. in the population, that they think differently, their brains develop differently. And sometimes that difference includes strengths and talents.
Baron Cohen formulated the mind blindness theory of autism, which he published in 1995 and 1997. Mind blindness is a concept of a cognitive divergence, where an individual is unable to attribute mental states to others. As a result of this kind of social and cognitive phenomenon, the individual is incapable of putting themselves into someone else's shoes and cannot conceptualize, understand, or predict knowledge, thoughts, beliefs, emotions, feelings, desires, behaviors, actions, and intentions of the other person. And the mind blindness theory asserts that children who delay in this development often will develop autism. He also formulated the fetal sex steroid theory of autism, which was published in 2015. This theory states that fetal testosterone influences the development of certain structures in the brain, and that these changes relate to behavioral traits seen as those with autism. Males generally have higher levels of fetal testosterone, contributing to their brain development in a particular way. He also made major contributions to the fields of typical cognitive sex differences and screening, prevalence, autism genetics, autism neuroimaging, and autism and technical abilities. And on the top of that, he was knighted in 2021 for services for autistic people.
So I started as a teacher in a small unit, a small school for autistic children. There were just 6 children in the school and there were 6 teachers, so it was 1-to-1. So for me, I just graduated from university and I had this teaching opportunity, and it was an opportunity really to get to know autistic children in a lot of detail, to get to know their families. It was at a time when we didn't know much about autism. This was the early 1980s, and there were many misconceptions about autism. For example, that autism was the result of the way the parents had treated their child, that the parents were not emotional enough with their child. So there was very little understanding that autism was neurological, so a result of brain development and partly genetic. We just didn't know that back then. But I got fascinated and I went to do a PhD in autism research. And as you can probably hear, I'm still fascinated, but I'm also equally passionate about taking the research and translating it into making the world more comfortable for autistic people.
Okay, that's a very interesting perspective. As a start, I would like to ask you, how do you define autism?
Yeah. So autism is a diagnosis. So ultimately, it's a medical clinical diagnosis, and it's based on social difficulties, communication difficulties, but also difficulties with dealing with unexpected change. So autistic people like predictability. In addition, many autistic people have sensory hypersensitivity. So they might find lights too bright or sounds too loud, or have a preference for very specific tastes and foods and textures. But it's the word autism, in my opinion, should be reserved for people who are struggling because they need extra support.
How frequent is autism in the society?
Yeah, so autism used to be very rare. So when I started in autism in research 40 years ago, we thought it was 4 children in every 10,000. Today we realize it's very common, at least 1% of the population, maybe as high as 2%, so 1 in 50 children or adults will now get a diagnosis of autism. And because it's now so common, it just means we need a lot more support services.
In your studies, you link between the attitudes towards understandings of systems and autism. Is there any evidence that this capability of systematic thinking can be turned into invention? Do you have any evidence on that link?
Yeah. So we conducted a big study. It was online, of 600,000 people in the population. And they took several questionnaires. One of them was a measure of autistic traits, how many autistic traits you have. And it turns out we all have some autistic traits, and some people have more than others. And if you look at people in that big study who work in STEM, science, technology, engineering, or mathematics, on average, they have more autistic traits than people who do not work in STEM. So that's just one example of a link between higher levels of autistic traits and aptitude or talent in understanding systems. We asked them to do another questionnaire, which is looking at systems thinking. We call it the systemizing quotient. And we found that people who score high in systemizing, we looked at their DNA, their genetics, and we found they have a big overlap between the genetics of autism. So even at the molecular level, there's a link between talent at understanding systems and the genes for autism. And then maybe a third example, and I talked about this in Copenhagen, was that we looked at the city of Eindhoven in the Netherlands, because Eindhoven is it's a bit like Silicon Valley. It's like a center for IT, for information technology. Eindhoven has the Philips factory there for 100 years, so attracting people who are good at systems thinking. And it's also got the Institute of Technology there, which is a bit like MIT, so attracting the best scientists and computer scientists and engineers. What we found was that in Eindhoven, the rate of autism amongst the children was twice as high as in any other Dutch city. So again, it's giving us a clue that there's a link between talent in the parents in systems thinking and likelihood of autism in their children. So presumably a genetic link.
In your study, you showed that people who had many autistic traits were less capable of understanding other people's feelings, like they had less empathy in average. You also argue that the invention is driven by systematic thinking plus empathy. So then how can people who has many autistic traits drive invention without empathy?
So first of all, in that big study, the 600,000 people, we also gave them the empathy quotient. So that measures how easily you can recognize what someone is thinking and respond appropriately to what someone is thinking or feeling. We found that you're right, that as the people with higher autistic traits have more difficulty in empathy, and that in that big study, we also had 36,000 autistic people. So people with a formal diagnosis of autism. And again, you know, they score higher on systemizing, but they score below average on empathy. The point you made, which was people who are better at systemizing might also be better at invention. We've seen that in that study of STEM, you know, that people who work in STEM have higher systemizing, higher autistic traits. But I didn't make the claim that invention requires empathy. I mean, empathy is really evolved for something very different. You know, I think that systemizing evolved for invention, to understand how things work and to come up with new systems. But empathy evolved to help us navigate relationships, you know, to help us make relationships, keep relationships, and respond appropriately by helping others, by showing kindness. That's nothing to do with invention, just to clarify.
Yeah, but in the beginning of your talk, you had the example about the necklace that was invented to make somebody happy. So from that, I understood that you also related empathy to invention.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. So certainly you can see examples where an invention benefits from empathy. So, for example, we're talking through a video chat right now. That's an invention, but the motivation to invent this video call presumably also takes into account that people want to communicate. It will be easier to communicate face to face. So just like, you know, 70,000 years ago with the first, well, it was actually, I think, a bit more recent. I think it was about 40,000 years ago, the first jewelry. You know, the jewelry was like a necklace, was invented, you know, as something new. But the idea of why would you invent it in the first place might have involved empathy, because it could have been a gift, as you said, or it could have been because the person who wears it wanted to make an impression on an observer who's looking at them. So either way, this does involve empathy. But of course, you can have inventions without empathy. You know, a good, well, a clear example of that, it's not a nice example, was the gas chambers in the concentration camps were an invention, but presumably they were invented without any empathy because they were designed to kill. You know, weapons being used in Ukraine today are an invention, but presumably no empathy was needed to invent them because they're designed to kill. So inventions are not always always good.
Certainly not. Your study also shows that more men than women have autism. Can that be because women may be underdiagnosed?
Yeah, absolutely. So most of the big population studies shows that about 3 times more males than females are diagnosed as autistic. So for every 1 female, there are 3 males. So this could reflect, you know, that females are being missed, under-recognized, or even misdiagnosed. They could be being diagnosed with other labels, if you like social anxiety, but not autism. But it also could reflect differences in the causes of autism that are sex-linked. So autism is partly genetic, and some of the genes may be sex-linked. They may work differently in males than in females. Some of the causes of autism involve hormones prenatally, changing the brain and the way it develops, such as the hormones testosterone and estrogen. And again, these hormones, they differ naturally in their levels between males and females. So we need to kind of certainly encourage girls and women to explore a diagnosis if they feel that it might be relevant, not to feel that diagnosis is not available for them. You know, if they're struggling, they should seek a diagnosis, because another possibility is that fewer females are seeking a diagnosis because there's kind of more pressure on females to be sociable, more stigma about being autistic if you're female. And we need to destigmatize autism in males and females. But it may be that even when we have a better diagnosis, better recognition, we might still see a difference in the rates of autism between males and females for more biological reasons.
But this also leads me to the next question. Are some of the common genetic markers for autism on the Y chromosome, giving a potential explanation to why autism is more frequent in men?
So the Y chromosome, as you know, is only present in males, and females have 2 X chromosomes. And it may not be the presence of genes on the Y chromosome that increases the likelihood of autism in males, but it could be the presence of genes on the X chromosome, because males only have 1 X, not 2. So research is looking at what's called the female protective effect. Is there something in the biology of being female which reduces the likelihood of an autism diagnosis? I don't really like the word protective because it sounds like autism is something dangerous or bad that we need to be protected from. But that's often the language that's used in medical research. But I think, it's a valid question for science to understand what are the factors that might increase the likelihood of a diagnosis or reduce the likelihood of a diagnosis in both sexes.
To look a bit on the future, what do you think needs to be done in order to include people with autism more in the society?
Well, where do we start? there's so many things that need to be done. Let's start with employment. In my country, in the UK, the National Autistic Society estimates that 85% of autistic adults are unemployed. Even though they have skills, they have strengths, they are employable. So we have to understand what are the barriers to employment. Many autistic people they want to work, they are applying for jobs, but they're not even getting invited for an interview. So something's going on even at the early stage of applications for jobs. Some people are invited for jobs to an interview, but the interview is still very conventional. It's based on eye contact, on communication, on social skills. So in some ways, the interview methods are discriminating against this group of people with disabilities in those areas. So we have to change the selection methods. And some people get a job, some autistic people get a job, but then lose it because they're not being supported in work. So again, employers need to be educated about what does an autistic person need, that if you hire someone who's autistic, you'll get a fantastic employee because they have lots of skills, great attention to detail, focus to stay on a task for long periods, perfectionism. They don't like mistakes, they don't cut corners, but the autistic person may need some reasonable adjustments at work. For example, predictability, that they're always going to sit at the same desk, very clear planning so that things don't change unexpectedly. Maybe sensory issues, like being allowed to wear headphones if the office is too noisy. So small adjustments could make it easier to employ autistic people. But that's just one example of how society could be more inclusive. The same applies to education. A lot of autistic kids are being excluded, which means not allowed to go to school because their behavior is seen as difficult or challenging. Sometimes young autistic kids will shout it's called a meltdown or a tantrum when things are maybe overwhelming for them. But instead of saying to the child, you're not welcome at the school, you have to leave school, we need to, again, make reasonable adjustments, giving the child some time in a quiet space to sort of calm down, to de-stress, and maybe also recognizing that autistic children and adults in the educational setting, they learn differently. They might prefer to learn in a solitary way from a book rather than in a group, for example. So it's very different to the majority, but we have to make space for different learning styles to allow every child to reach their potential. So those are just two examples.
Okay, but that also leads me to the next question. Do you think that the children who have autism, they should go to specialized schools, or do you think they should be included in the ordinary school system?
I don't think we should be dogmatic about this. Some kids might do better in a school just for autistic kids. Others might do better in a mainstream school, but where there's additional support. I think there should be a variety of kinds of schools so that parents can visit and make a choice about what's best for their child. I think, you know, there may be some principles that are common to both specialist schools and more general schools. One of the principles might be small class size, you know, that some autistic people might, or children, might learn better if the number of children in the class is not too large. In the so-called special schools, sometimes they just have 6 children in the class. So it's much quieter, much more individual attention for each child. We have to look more at kind of what are the teaching methods and the context, as opposed to whether it's in a mainstream school or not.
Some of the things people with autism often struggles with is, as you mentioned before, social skills in general. And this is one of the big challenges for how the society can embrace those people despite those social difficulties. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, if we think about, you know, social difficulties in autism as a disability, if we make the analogy with physical disability, you know, if a person can't walk and they need to be in a wheelchair, we don't stigmatize them, we don't judge them negatively, and we don't exclude them. So, you know, nowadays, institutions, public spaces, they have stairs for people who can use stairs, and they have ramps for people who are in wheelchairs. So we have to use the same kind of logic for these disabilities in the mind, not in the body. You know, if somebody has difficulties socially, maybe other people, the neurotypical people, have to make it easier for that person. So not put pressure on them. If the person takes a long time to reply when they're asked a question, give them time to process the information. If they don't want to talk but just want to sit quietly and watch, that's fine. You know, we shouldn't judge. If they only want to, or only feel confident to talk in a one-to-one relationship but not in a group, again, we shouldn't sort of make the person feel bad because of that. That may be at the limits of what they can cope with. So we just have to make reasonable adjustments. And with social skills, it's true, even in the general population, we all differ in how much we want to socialize. You know, some people want to have lots of friends. Some people only want to have 1 or 2 friends. Some people want to go out every night, you know, partying. Some people only occasionally. But one person isn't better or worse. These are just differences. And we shouldn't put pressure on autistic people or anyone else to conform to certain expectations. We should let people be who they are.
Thank you for listening to the Science and Cocktails podcast, which is funded by the Novo Nordisk Foundation and produced by me, Sophie Hjort. The music is made by Hjalte Bistad Hjort. And if you like what you heard, please pass it on. And if you haven't listened to other episodes, I hope you will. They're all quite different.